The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Hugh Muir, and in this month's Global Development podcast, we'll be examining the UK's aid programme.
To those who are sceptical, I would say it is not only the moral obligation that better-off countries have to tackle poverty, but it's also in our interests that we build a more prosperous world, because if we don't, the problems of conflict, the problems of mass migration, the problems of uncontrollable climate change, these are all problems that come and visit us at home.
UK aid has been a big news story lately, with more scrutiny of the Department for International Development's spending record and ongoing debate about the growing aid budget. Money spent through consultants, aid channelled to the Rwandan government, and funds channelled through the EU have reinvigorated debates about who does and who should benefit from ring-fenced British aid.
People in London not only want to communicate with people in other communities around the world, but they want to make sure that they have the things that Londoners take for granted. Sanitation, clean water, basic education, all the things that a serious aid programme can provide.
We now get a lot of correspondence from people who do think we should cut our aid budget. But what strikes me is that most people who contact me about this think we spend far more than we actually do on international development.
I think as Conservatives we can take incredible pride that when our chance came to govern, we increased the aid budget, even at a time when very difficult decisions have had to be made at home.
Key figures in the Conservative Party there defending the British aid budget. Despite growing pressure from within his own party, David Cameron has recently repeated his commitment to spend 0.7% of gross national income on aid by 2013. Coming up, we'll ask just who benefits from the growing British aid budget, what's the most effective way of spending aid, and what does Britain need to do to develop a credible aid exit strategy? As I say, plenty of headlines, and to learn more about the recent UK aid controversy, I'm joined from Colombia by Jonathan Glenny from the Overseas Development Institute. Jonathan, welcome to you. Why is UK aid under the spotlight?
Because all the other departments, apart from health, are facing cuts in order to cut the deficit that this coalition government has insisted on keeping aid not only at present levels, but actually increasing the amount of aid we give to other countries. And that obviously is quite a provocative position to take.
We're looking to get to 0.7 of our gross national income, and that will mean increasing the amount of aid. What is it now?
It's about 0.5% at the moment, and it's been increasing for a few years. And the 0.7% promise has been made decades ago, and it looks like finally the UK will live up to that promise. And I think the thing to remember is just how little it is compared with the scale of our economy. Yes, Britain is going through tough times at the moment. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But it's still one of the richest countries in the world by far. We're offering 5 pence in every pound at the moment, and we'll move up to 7 pence in every pound of our national income to countries that are far, far worse off than us. And I think the test of a great nation is not what it gives when it's going through good times, but the solidarity that it maintains when it's going through bad times. And that's why I think we should be very proud of our aid budget. And everyone signed up to it. Very few countries have met it. But it's a symbol of a small amount of giving to the rest of the world. And I think it's something that we should seek to keep. And actually, in my view, and this might be a little controversial, we should increase it.
So let's talk about the coalition and how it's organised its operation in terms of aid. A lot of it was under the stewardship of Andrew Mitchell, but he left that job, and more recently he's left another one. But tell us about the has there been a distinctive tone to the way the coalition have sought to approach the issue of aid?
I think the coalition has approached aid in quite a distinctive manner. I think there are some positive aspects to it, and possibly also some challenging aspects to it. I think Andrew Mitchell's legacy is focusing very on results, accountability and transparency. Those things were not just words to him. He really deeply felt all the research, and ODI is a research institute, and all the research that we've done demonstrates that if recipient countries are not in the lead, if they're not owning their own development strategy, it's much, much less likely that we're going to see those results. And I think the coalition government needs to emphasize much more that we're a supporting partner and that we can't lead too much from the outside. And this focus on value for money, again, I can understand why they've gone for it. They need to demonstrate that to the British public. But again, aid can be a risky business. You need to, just like in the private sector, you need to invest money, and sometimes you're losing. And we have to be honest about that. Otherwise, the British people will start to get skeptical. You know, sometimes aid is mismanaged. Sometimes aid is misused. Let's be upfront about it. It's just like any other sector, the health sector, the education sector. Sometimes things go wrong.
And joining me in the studio to discuss some of the issues raised by Jonathan, we have Deborah Doan, Director at the World Development Movement, Owen Bader, Director for Europe at the Centre for Global Development, and Joe Powell, Senior Policy and Advocacy Manager at the Campaign Group One. Welcome to all of you. I should add at the outset that we did ask DFID to participate in this debate, but they didn't feel able to, which is a shame, but we'll move on. Let's start with the recent drama over the £500 million spent by DFID last year on a small group of primarily British consultants. The Sunday Telegraph made a big fuss about this, and Justine Greening has since addressed it a bit. She said in her conference speech, "I'm determined to make sure that the DFID budget is spent wisely, which is why I'm introducing new financial controls. And one of my first acts in office was to commission work on the use of consultants."
So I think it's excellent that DFID is coming under this kind of scrutiny, and I think they welcome it. I think they are happy to see people crawling over the details of where the money is going. But I also think they're quite relaxed about the idea that they should be spending quite a bit of aid money on private consultants. If you ask most people in the street, do you think we should be teaching people how to run their own financial management systems or their own health service, they say yes. And the people who do that are consultants. And so when we spend a lot of money, consultant sounds bad, but having somebody go out to Afghanistan and help the Afghanistan government set up a public financial management system that works, most people would think that's a good use of public money.
It doesn't come cheap, though, does it?
No. Development is an expensive, difficult, risky business.
Joe, have you been worried about the consultancy story?
I think the first thing to say is that DFID is the most transparent donor in the world, so it's great that we can actually access this information, because there are many donors where, as far as we know, the situation could be much worse or better, but we can't find out. I think, secondly, right at the start of this government, Andrew Mitchell said he would sign up to the same civil service cuts at DFID as every other government department, so a 30% cut. But, of course, the DFID budget was rising, next year going up around £3 billion.
Yeah.
So there's clearly a tension there, which is going to result in more outside help coming in. So I think perhaps Justine Greening, along with saying that she'll look at £1 million contracts, which I think, frankly, will be a short-term move given how much will now pass across her desk, she should also look again at signing up to those Whitehall cuts.
But Deborah, when you get to the point where people are talking about poverty barons, it doesn't help, does it?
Well, the problem is, it's the spend on the consultants is just the tip of the iceberg. It's what those consultants are recommending. We've seen, the Adam Smith Institute, which is one of the big villains in the story. Many years ago, they were given £250,000 to promote water privatization in Tanzania, which didn't serve the poorest, including promoting a pop song. They were given millions to promote privatization, £250,000 for the pop song. The fact that she wants to scrutinize every spend, actually, she would be much better to oversee and look at the strategic policy of DFID, which leads to those types of expenditures. It's the overarching policy that's DFID's driving, that's leading to spending on consultants, spending on global multinationals, subsidizing multinationals rather than actually supporting the poorest, social services, and so on.
Well, Deborah, let's look at what we're trying to do, because in the 1990s, your group, the World Development Movement, was heavily involved in campaigns to sever the ties between the UK aid budget and British commercial interests. Tell us a bit about that, but let me again turn to the esteemed Justine Greening, because she's spoken on this as well, and she says that her reasoning behind aid is that it's in all our interests for countries around the world to be stable and secure, to have educated and healthy populations, and to have growing economies. Many countries where we work have the same potential to be growth markets of tomorrow. So when you hear her say that, do you smell a rat?
It's edging on illegality. It's in a grey area, I think. The Pyrgo Dam case proved, we took a case to the British High Court that was challenging the use of British aid money to promote private interests and trade interests for the UK in Malaysia. We won that case, and the High Court agreed that aid must be used absolutely for poverty reduction and not for trade. And that was a very clear case. It was quite groundbreaking at the time. And, you know, as we're with the latest coalition government, we're moving very closely back to the territory of aid for trade. Now, it is a grey line, but it is something we're absolutely concerned about. We've seen under her predecessor, Andrew Mitchell, you know, he wants 50% of aid in India, and that's another subject I assume we'll get on to, 50% of aid in India to go towards building up the private sector in India. And that's clearly because the government sees that as in our trade potential rather than actually the needs of poverty reduction in India, and that's what we're very concerned about.
Irene, are they moving in the wrong direction?
Yeah, I think we're blurring a whole bunch of different things here. One is the use of private consultants in the delivery of aid, some of which may be delivering projects and programs and policies of which the World Development Movement doesn't approve, but much of it is not. Much of it is consultants who are training teachers or training public servants or working with health systems of the kind that organizations like the World Development Movement would be in favor.
But Owen, you're making an assumption that it's the private that it's private consultants who do that best. In fact, after a lot of our water campaigning in places like Tanzania, the European Union put 40 million euros behind public partnerships, so public water systems can partner with developing countries to show how it can be done without the use of private consultants.
And I think you should make a separate choice in each case about who the best provider is for the kind of training and capacity building and support that you're trying to provide. I don't think you should begin with an assumption that the best person to do this is a member of DFID staff or some other public employee. It might very well be that you have real experts. But let's move on. There's a second question, which is the extent to which we use public money, aid money, to support the private sector in developing countries. And you may think that that's inappropriate. But actually, if you talk to most people in developing countries, what they want is jobs. What they want, what both governments and citizens of developing countries want, is opportunities to grow their way out of poverty, not to be receiving aid in future.
But
and there's nothing wrong with us using the aid budget to support that. And that, when you talk about aid for trade, that's what aid for trade is. Then there's a third question, which is whether we're using the aid budget to promote British goods and services, British exports, on which the World Development Movement quite rightly fought an extremely important landmark case.
Are we? Should we?
No, I don't think we should. And we don't. It's against the law, as Deborah says.
I want to move on because we did ask people to send in questions and observations. And I have a question here from our talk point on the Global Development website. PUDSK, I won't try and pronounce that, but that's the poster. And they ask, who gives more, the UK government through aid, which of course is partly paid for by taxation, or the UK public through charitable donations? I'll throw that open to whoever would best like to answer.
The UK public give about $11 billion a year to charities, but that's not all overseas charity. But, for example, Comet Relief last year had their most successful ever fundraising drive, and that was about £80 million last year. So the government is clearly giving more to overseas programmes than the British public.
I mean, how important are the public, though? I mean, the very concept of aid is having a bit of a rough ride at the moment, isn't it?
Well, let's be clear. When the government gives money, they're giving the British taxpayers money. So it's the British public, whether it's through private giving through charities or through the Department for International Development and other parts of official aid. Now, so public support for this is extremely important. And what's interesting is that public support for concern about development is strong and rising. In the recent Eurobarometer survey published this month, 85% of the British public said it was important or very important to support people in developing countries. What's less clear is how much they support government-to-government aid. That is much more unpopular than the idea of working on development. They're much more sceptical that our aid programme is actually making the difference that we say it's making. And there the numbers are nearer 50 or 60%. But it's still quite high levels of support.
So do you think then that the government are actually catching the public mood in terms of the way they're choosing to proceed?
I think one thing that always interests me is that many ministers seem to think that they should defend aid on the basis that it's in Britain's national interest, that it's in our security interest or our economic interest to give money to poor countries or to help poor countries develop. What the opinion polls seem to show us, and the focus groups and discussions with people seem to show us, is that that doesn't resonate with the public at all. What resonates with the public is the moral obligation that we have, the solidarity that we have with people in developing countries.
I think in the same way as with our own public services, people fundamentally believe in the NHS. They believe in its value. They believe that healthcare should be free at the point of service, but they don't like seeing when money is going awry. So I think that's the same analogy. I also think the important point to make is that aid is not development. Aid is one way in which we pursue development and poverty reduction, but development is a much bigger picture, and we have been blurring those lines quite a bit recently.
Okay, let's look at a specific instance that's been causing quite a lot of controversy and created a few headlines, because, of course, the gone but never forgotten Andrew Mitchell reinstated millions in previously frozen aid to the Rwandan government just before leaving his post last month. And of course, this was highly controversial because the Rwandan government's been accused of supporting rebels in the neighbouring Democratic Republic of Congo. I mean, who's right here? Should donors suspend aid to governments like Rwanda when there are allegations like this?
I think this is a really interesting problem for development. And we see it in Rwanda. We've also seen it over the years in Ethiopia. What happens where you have a state that is effective at improving the welfare of its people through economic growth and through providing good public services, but which has a human rights record or a democratic record that we think is not sufficiently progressive and not moving in the right direction? And it seems to me that those people who argue that we should cut aid or change the way we give aid in those circumstances need to set out more clearly what the case for that is. Because we are clear, and I don't think anyone disputes, that the aid we give to Rwanda makes a huge difference to people's lives. There's something like 50,000 children in school because of British aid, something like 1.25 million bed nets that people are sleeping under to prevent them from getting malaria. So the question is, for what would we cut off those benefits? Because those are also human rights. People's right to an education or not to catch malaria is a right. So we would need to be pretty confident that either cutting off aid or changing the way we give aid, if we were going to reduce those benefits, would have some other benefit to those people that would enhance those human rights. And I'm not clear what that benefit is.
I'll turn to Joe then. Joe, what's the answer?
Well, it comes back again to what we're giving aid for. You know, as Deborah rightly said, we are, by law, our aid has to go to reducing poverty. You know, and Rwanda has taken 1 million people out of poverty in the last 5 years, one of the most impressive poverty reduction rates in Africa. Ethiopia was similarly impressive, but as Owen said, had similar human rights challenges. But I think also in Rwanda, the one thing people I haven't seen commented on recently is the context. And, you know, Rwandan genocide was only 16 years ago. You know, there are rebels in eastern Congo that were involved in that genocide that are still threatening to the Rwandan state. You know, when we send NATO halfway around the world to Afghanistan to deal with the Taliban, you know, suddenly there's, you know, a lot of people are in agreement. But Kagame feels that on his doorstep there are people challenging the functioning of his state and the security of his state. So I think we have to be very, very careful about the double standards we apply to when African countries are trying to secure their own borders as to when we take similar decisions.
Okay, well, we've talked about how aid should be distributed, but of course there are debates about whether we should have it at all. Let's hear now from Feroz Manji. He's founder of PAM's Bazooka Press, a Pan-African social justice website. He's also a former Africa director for Amnesty International. And I spoke to him earlier and asked him about his reservations about foreign aid.
Well, I think that the fundamental purpose of aid is to provide the mechanism of exploitation of the global south. There have been many studies which have been looking at the nature of aid and how much actually aid goes in one direction and how much comes back in another. A study by Charles Obugre, then at Christian Aid, showed that over the period 2002 to 2007, the alleged increase in aid over that period was entirely accountable for by the cancellation of debt of Iraq and Nigeria. the debt is part of the equation of giving aid, then obviously we must have a look at how much comes back in terms of servicing of aid, payment for servicing of aid, and how much aid actually goes out. In other words, the whole purpose of aid is indeed to move money out of the global south.
What was your reaction when you see the stats that the government will sometimes put out, that our aid, $8.6 billion in 2011, has helped 12 million children fight off preventable diseases, enabled 11.9 million people to work their way out of poverty, helped 6 million people with emergency food assistance? Isn't that a good thing?
These are all mythical figures. The reality is... If you
all of them?
Yes, all of them. If you have a look at the last 30 years alone, overall in the global south, there are more poor people, more hungry people, there's greater landlessness, there's greater exploitation of natural resources that is happening over that entire period.
Doesn't that speak to the scale of the problem?
Well, I mean, the reality is that is a situation that has been created. In Africa, most countries are worse off today than they were under colonialism. That is a damning indictment of the nature of aid.
So what should be happening? There are rich countries, there are poor countries. Should the rich world be leaving the poor world to get on with it?
Well, absolutely. I think the reality is that the reason why most of the global south is poor is because most of its wealth is being drawn out and extracted from those countries. Indeed, if they stop doing that, we would actually be much richer. If one looks at, for example, the reports of the Tax Justice Network, which demonstrates an extraordinarily high rate of tax avoidance schemes by the very companies that the DFID and other international development agencies underwrite. There is grand-scale exploitation going on.
Feroz Manji there. I see furrowed brows all around the table. Owen, I think you're getting quite keen to get stuck in, so you go first.
It seems to me there are extremely cogent reasons for worrying about aid, but that wasn't one of them. And I think we should separate a whole bunch of separate questions here. To say, because parts of sub-Saharan Africa are still poor, or even poorer than they were 40 years ago, is absolutely true. But to say that that is because of aid, rather than despite aid, is evidently not the case. To say, as I think he's absolutely right to say, that we should be concerned about extractive industries and illicit financial flows from developing countries to rich countries, absolutely true. But to suggest that our aid program is in some sense underwriting transfer pricing or extraction by Western companies, again, absolute nonsense. So yes, there are good reasons to think about whether and how we give aid, but that argument was just as cogent as saying we provide healthcare to millions of people and yet they still die. The right question is, would they be worse off without it or better without it? And there is enormous and very compelling evidence that on average, aid has a positive effect on people's lives. Does it solve all the world's problems? Absolutely no. Would I stand in solidarity with him in saying we should tackle illicit financial flows? Yes. Is aid driving that problem? Absolutely not.
Deborah, I just want to refer to another post that we received. This time our poster was called Ethnic Supplies, and she said, "I'm concerned about increased political conditionality with respect to foreign aid. I'm not entirely sure how it helps the poor, and it may in fact come across as merely satisfying the foreign policy of the donor." I mean, that is a worry, isn't it?
I think this goes back to an earlier point we were talking about insofar as aid is a moral obligation. Aid is about redistribution of wealth and solving global inequality. Aid shouldn't be about saying, just like we were talking about in the Rwanda case, about this is what you have to do with that condition. I think we have to think of aid as differently, aid in a different way, that it's about what we give to the world because we are wealthy. As much as we think we're going through hard times, developing countries are going through extraordinarily difficult times. That being said, where I would agree with Feroz is, you know, if aid is going in, but actually so much money is coming out for servicing debt, for the fact that companies who we are subsidizing through the aid budget to deliver jobs, allegedly in developing countries, are not paying their taxes, aid is being actually used to undermine the ability of those governments to provide for the needs of their people. So I think where Feroz is right is that yes, we should be giving aid, absolutely. And I would actually argue we probably need to be giving more aid as a contribution to our global citizenship. But what we should be mostly doing is focusing on those other ways that countries can provide for themselves and deliver for their people. And that is through tax justice, through trade justice, through writing off debt, which is an issue that one knows well about.
So let me talk about other people that aid should be going to. We referred to Rwanda, but let me read you a quote from Justine Greening. She says, "We should focus our efforts on helping countries that are less able to help themselves, and on countries where our work can really speed up economic development. And we should also recognise that as countries get richer, we need to be responsible about how we organise our transition, our relationship with them, from aid to trade." With that in mind, how do we end up giving aid to India and China?
Well, I think there's been a risk with our whole conversation today in that we miss one of the most fundamental trends in Africa over the last 10 years, which is their own capacity to raise domestic resources has increased hugely. So we know that in last year, there's $340 billion, which are domestically raised resources for African governments to have at their disposal, compared to aid of $48 billion. So actually, of course, we should do more on things like transfer pricing and tax evasion and illicit financial flows. But what we can also do is help ensure that those domestically raised resources are used more effectively to fight poverty. So I think one of the things when we think about how we deal with countries that are now middle income status and what type of aid we should give them, I think one way that Justine Greening should go is look to increase support to, for example, not only tax authorities and revenue collection, but also for civil society to actually be able to hold their leaders accountable for this big increase in domestically generated resources. And then we look at the whole transparency and accountability agenda, and I think there's some really exciting things that DFID could be doing in that space that isn't just our kind of the old transactional aid approach that we've been spending most of today talking about.
Owen Barda, very quickly.
I think there's an interesting synergy between what Deborah's saying and what Justine Greening is saying, according to her quotation, which is that we should be wanting to move to a world where developing countries in Africa, can support themselves through their own economic growth and prosperity and don't need aid. They don't want to be receiving aid. We don't want to be giving aid. I think that I absolutely agree that it's in the meantime, it's a moral obligation on us to be providing aid, and I think the strongest case against political conditionality is that it doesn't work. But what I think is worrying about our conversation about aid and the way we approach aid is if it detracts attention from all those other things that we could and should be doing to create an environment in which developing countries can grow. So trade justice, absolutely, tax justice, absolutely, environmental justice, and our focus on climate change and what we're doing there. The migration as a very important driver of development and rising prosperity. Things like intellectual property and the way we prevent technology transfer between rich countries and poor countries. The way we sell arms to poor countries. There's a whole series of issues where we in the rich world could be doing more to create an environment in which poor countries can grow. And I think that is much more powerful, that set of policy changes, than anything we can do with aid.
I think if we look at aid, if we start to redefine aid as, again, our contribution to global citizenship, I would not want us to see us ever, you know, certainly not in the next 10 to 20 years, let's see what happens with the world, stop giving money to those who are who need it. And just using a UK example again, the southeast of England is very wealthy, but we still provide money to education and to healthcare in that region. Why would we stop doing it elsewhere in the world? If we need to redistribute income globally, we should do that for as long as we need to.
Okay, well, let's talk about the future. And Deborah, first of all, what would happen if UK aid was cut completely. You've heard Feroz Manji basically arguing for that, but what would be the effect of that?
But from what I gather, I don't think there is a plan to scale down that aid, and all of the political parties are committed to upholding our commitment on aid.
But certainly within the Conservative Party, there are people who would like dramatic reductions.
Within the Conservative Party, but the government, the coalition government, is committed to keeping our obligations to aid, and we shouldn't be undermining that and just holding them to commit for that account.
You're confident that will hold?
More importantly, I want to focus on those issues that will lead to development and the ability of countries to strengthen. I think if we keep – I do agree. If we keep bandering about aid, aid is just a drop in the ocean when it comes to actually the wider issues of development, about security, about the global economic crisis that has crippled us all. So, you know, aid is our contribution. The government, the coalition government, the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats, and the Labour Party have all committed to it. And, you know, let's hold them to that and assume that they will.
I mean, DFID is the Department for International Development. Aid is obviously an important tool, but there must be other tools. What else should they be doing to help developing countries?
Well, to some extent they are, and for example, DFID has got a very good record on trade policy, where it established a trade unit that really helped change not just UK, but world policy on trade with respect to developing countries. We have a long way to go on that agenda to have trade justice, but at least the idea that trade is a development issue was put on the map there. But there are a lot of issues that we're just not making progress on, and I would count on them migration, where there is just an inadequate discussion about the role of migration in development, on things like arms sales and security, on illicit financial flows, on multinational companies and transfer pricing, on corruption. There's a whole set of issues on which we really need to have a cross-government approach to make sure that our policy agenda supports developing countries. And in most of these cases, these are acts not of deliberate sin, but of omission. In most cases, we simply are not thinking hard enough about the impact on developing countries of some of the policy choices we make. Not because people are deliberately grinding the faces of the poor, but because there is simply no mechanism within not only the British government, but any government, to take account of these global priorities when they're setting domestic national policies.
I would disagree that DFID has been progressive on trade. Opening up trade, you know, there's been a stall in the Doha round, which in some cases is a very good thing. But opening up increased trade is actually potentially making countries more vulnerable. The World Bank, the UN Rapporteur on the Right to Food have all said that actually we need to slow down on certain trade approaches because it's not enabling countries to be resilient enough, especially in the areas of food. So what's happening in the retail sector, the European Union has negotiated a bilateral agreement with trade with India. Opening up the retail sector is going to devastate small businesses, small producers in India.
Joe, at least we had some clarity with the Millennium Development Goals. It was clear, and it was a rallying cry in a way, wasn't it? But of course, the Millennium Development Goals expire in 2015. What do you think should happen next?
The start of the conversation on that has been quite positive, because what you've seen is issues like inequality that were not represented at all in 2000 actually coming up as something that people really feel like should be included. Issues of equity, so it's not just, you know, getting somebody into school, but the quality of that education. And actually, I think it's a very good thing that David Cameron has a seat at the top table of that conversation, given our track record and the fact that DFID is one of the most effective development agencies or development ministries in the world. The only other thing I think is vitally important is that there has to be a proper consultation of the people who these goals are actually meant to be for. So there needs to be proper polling of developing countries. There needs to be focus groups and all the tools at our disposal to actually ask people what they want. Because when we did that on past data, people said top of the list was jobs. And then we can have a debate about if it's actually appropriate to have jobs in a Millennium Development Goal framework or not.
Well, thank you all for your contributions. That's about all we have time for on this month's Global Development Podcast. My thanks to Deborah Doan, Owen Barder and Joe Powell. This is, of course, a strange time where aid is on all of the front pages. That may or may not be a good thing in terms of how it progresses. But you can also keep up on what's happening in this continuing story on guardian.co. www.ifid.org.uk/globaldevelopment, and you'll see all of our development stories there. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Hugh Muir. The producer was Peter Sale. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.